Tokens are everywhere. They run through the fabric of everyday life. They are recognizable by man and machine alike. But in 1948, tokens wouldn't have looked like this, but more like this. These are examples from the field that is technically called paranumismatics. And this field is not about money or legal tender, but it is about tokens. So that's the definition of this. These tokens have one thing in common, and that is that they're not issued by a legal state or a nation. They can store all different kinds of properties, not only monetary value, and just to give you a few examples, you can have guerrilla monies that are there before the state really occurs, as here in Cuba. Or you can have tokens that measure differently, that measure the hours you have worked. You have cooperative money. For example, it measures and stores how much it stores the parts of the profit the cooperative makes from you and redeems what you have given to it. And, of course, there are more sinister forms. Plantation monies, for example. You get your wage in one of those tokens, but the value is not redeemable except in the shops that the plantation runs itself. So this is a really strong direction of buying power. Some of the tokens are, of course, less visible, and I will be looking at the formation of three of those, at the formation of three international units, on procedures of standardization involved in this, and at a genealogy of international tokenization. As always with genealogies, this is just one path through the whole field. You could have chosen many others. But I've wanted to contribute to this discussion on autonomous systems of the technosphere that we shouldn't probably reify technology and that tokens are formed in international agreements at one place. There's treaty making. Tokens have a legal side to them. And for this, I will visit three international conventions at which such tokens were at stake. And one is the 1851 metric currency. Another token I want to talk about is the UNRWA unit. And for me, it's the most important unit of the 1940s. I will explain why. And in 1944, I will briefly dwell on the banker. Sadly, though, my tokens have failed, and none of those tokens is with us today. Wandering through Richard Paxton's Crystal Palace, visitors could marvel at the world of exotisms presented to them. And at the 1851 International Exposition in London, some might have done just that. Others, though, other visitors may have noticed how difficult it was to gauge the technology on display. What was the measure of these machines? Their impact, their capacity, their volume. Subsequently, all exhibitors were requested to translate the specifics of their product in terms of the metric system. In parallel, we see the formation of an international association and the publication of a declaration of opinion for obtaining a uniform decimal system of weights, measures, and coins. And that's the point I wanted to make. The metric system had the tendency to extend to monetary units. At that time, it seemed natural. The association heralded itself as having made a remarkable progress for the history of civilization. It was a happy movement which brings all nations together in the path of their industry. So I guess there are two forces at play here. Firstly, we can see that the language of standardization gains momentum in a technocratic industrial context. I can only echo the historian of law, Milos Več, in this point. He has described technical norms as a veritable new chapter of rulemaking. Standards did not emerge in the traditional way, so there weren't politicians or executive representatives involved, no diplomats. Instead, industrial negotiations took on an internationalist side. Norms were organized by corporations and especially by engineers. Standardization even paved the way for other international treaty making, and it is epitomized by the 1857 Meter Convention. Another force forging this metric currency is, secondly, a universal language that is employed. And I want to add this with Lucy Dresel, who, as a Jew, managed to get a PhD from the Kaiser Wilhelm University, but did not get to live until 1948. In her history of world money, Mirabeau, Prieur de la Côte d'Or, and Talleyrand take center stage. For them, combining this currency with a metric system would invent a monnaie commune, a unit based on the natural and universal standard. These tokens would be grounded in nature, such as to be available for every nation on Earth. And the specifically Occidental language of quantification is what I wanted to stress here, because I think in the next talk we will be hearing more about the narrowness of this universalism, but still, it is an important building block, I guess, of this token. The technocratic personnel and the industry itself take over the process of norm setting. That's important. And this procedure may be somewhat blurred by this language borrowed from the French Revolution. When we come to the 1940s, we see an increased occurrence of international conventions that can be observed in minor towns around Washington, D.C. Here you see a Hot Springs conference on food and agriculture. The international is rather congruent with allied forces at this time. In fact, many meetings are attended by 44 nations at the time. This would, of course, include Russia and China, but of course exclude Germany and Japan. Radically changing is, of course, this mixture of nations after 1948. And discussions in these conventions focus on two destabilizing factors. They focus on bread prices and exchange rates. Both problems involve new tokens or making of international units, as I want to show. And just for reminding everybody that the people attending these conferences would have had ample experience of the hyperinflation of the 1920s, the Great Depression, of the New Deal, of every country's own fate with the gold standard, and so on. So it was a time where all the nations had broken off the gold standard, but interventionist policies were very much the order of the day. And here we could go into further detail with Lionel Robbins and the Commode Program, or the founding of the Food and Agricultural Organization that built statistics and was organizing seeds, as we have seen yesterday. But I will focus on two other, as I was mentioning, on two other units, the UNRWA unit. And I apologize for this picture, but you will see in the next slide where I had to choose it. The United, this setup of this conference is really standardized, and sometimes I have the impression that it just carried the flags to the next hotel, but you will see about that. The convention resulted in the UNRWA unit. This unit was decided upon by the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration, which was founded in 1943. The declared aim was to take over and assist people after the military had left, to plan, coordinate, administer, or arrange for the administration of measures for the relief of victims of war in any area under the control of any of the United Nations through the provision of food, fuel, clothing, shelter, and other basic necessities, medical and other essential services. So we see what is really at stake here is the bare necessities, the basic needs. It's about vital goods. Some say the UNRWA produced prisoners of peace, but initially they assisted people left stranded in Poland, France, Lithuania, from Latvia, Yugoslavia, Russia, the Ukraine. Many of them should be repatriated, and that was only part of it. So corn might be shipped from Argentina to China, and livestock could be distributed. It was a worldwide operation. For this, UNRWA used the UNRWA unit, and what you have to do if you want to distribute vital goods, you need a bureaucracy. And here you see like that they started printing all these empty sheets, and it's important to note that the token, the UNRWA token, is always personalized, and that's probably the most futuristic about it, that these kind of tokens did not only have a material value, so some good that you could get for them, but that they were identity cards at the same time. Of course, you have to develop a classification for people. How does a normal person rank in comparison to a refugee, a mentally challenged person, or a policeman who gets the best in this example? In 1943, when you get to the material, where do you get the material to distribute? Many donor countries were involved, but this chart, of course, is again from the US, how to collect clothes, preferably from the people who weren't returning from the war. How could you get these channeled through the UNRWA into the world as we see it here? Of course, in the end, you have to distribute. It looks a bit less sophisticated. It's a photo, back of the photo reads, discharging UNRWA corn by the bucket method, and it's situated in south of Poland. But if you say now that this UNRWA unit is probably not very powerful, I just remind you that in this time, it was just the international way of a national standard, that rationing tokens were used in all the war economies to distribute the basic needs, and up to 70% or 60% of the commodities would just be transferred by this redistributive tokens. Another example from France. So the 1940s, the late 1940s, were very much token-based. And I think that this international UNRWA unit is probably my token of tokens for the time. And this is important when we come to the 1944 Bretton Woods Conference, in the sense that it was about stabilizing exchange rates, but it was at the same time preventing wars and hunger to happen again. Here at the opening ceremony, where Henry Morgenthau addresses the representatives from 44 nations in the mountains of New Hampshire. All in all, there were 730 participants, assisted by well-briefed American staff, with Boy Scouts volunteering to carry the few available microphones. Wall Street banks were successfully outmaneuvered. Henry Morgenthau, we are Secretary of Treasury, apparently wanted the unit to be called Mondor. He notes, though, that Franklin D. Roosevelt wanted it to be called a trade dollar, or demos, or indeed a victor. The US, in the end, won the conference, as we know, but apparently the general architects of the monetary conference were other personalities. Left, you see, the not very well-known Harry Dexter White. He advocated a token called Unitas. But it was, in fact, more another name for the dollar, and the dollar became the new leading currency of the world. White had drafted it, before that, White had drafted ideas about Pan-American banks and had a lot of contact with these banks. And this is what Eric Hellerner tells us, that we shouldn't just see this Bretton Woods conference as a kind of dollar-sterling diplomacy, but that we should acknowledge the especially huge impact from Latin America. But again, we may hear more about that from our next speaker. Harry Dexter White, again, did not see the get to live until 1949. He was debunked by the CIA as a Russian spy and died of a heart attack. the other key figure of the conference, the British representative John Maynard Keynes. This sheds some light on the relevance of tokens at stake. The reason for the international convention was the predicted sums needed or necessary to rebuild the war-torn countries, and the banker or unitas would be used each time a country needed credit. But what was so special about the banker? So the banker was a supranational fiat reserve currency. No person or company would have touched it, only sovereign states. It was a fiat currency backed against nothing. And of course, we know that Great Britain just had lost all of its gold reserves to the United States. So the banker was a fiat currency artificial unit for nations to keep their books about their debts, their imports, and their exports balanced. The aim would have been to possess the zero banker. If you had too much or too little, you would have been financially disciplined by this clearing union that they wanted to set up, and each national currency would have been tied with some elasticity to the banker. The banker itself would be the anchor of it all, so to reestablish some stability that was still flexible enough to react to cycles of the national economies. But we know that this clearing union didn't happen. And I just want to briefly sketch that there's, of course, much more economic fantasy behind this. There is a genealogy of the League of Nations that goes through the International Valuta Association that was promoted by the League of Nations. Or you have Friedrich Ernst Schumacher, who was inventing a clearing union as well. Most interestingly, though, there were plans to back money not only against gold, but against grain. It was suggested by Graham that some kind of bimaterialism could happen, not silver and gold, but commodities as a backup. That would have been very nice for, of course, for nations that had these materials, but not metal enough. So what was really lost with the banker? When Keynes returned and he addressed the House of Lords back in England, he found a rather biblical simile. "Your lordships will remember how little any of us liked the names proposed. Banker, Unitas, Dolphin, Besant, Derrick, and heaven knows what. Some of your lordships were good enough to join in the search for something better. I," and this is still Keynes speaking, "I recall a story of a country parish in the last century where they were accustomed to giving their children biblical names as Amos, Ezekiel, Obadiah, and so forth. Needing a name for a dog, after a long and vain search of the scriptures, they called their dog Moreover. We hit on no such happy solution, with the result that it has been the dog that died. And it might have dawned on some of the lords that the British Empire was really at stake here." So thanks a lot.